We're on the record. I'm Sheila Cass. Good morning. There's never a bad time to start making healthier choices. Grocery shopping is an opportunity to add more vegetables to your cart. Meditation might become part of your bedtime routine. Or if you are one of the 30 million Americans who use cigarettes, today could be the day you give up smoking. What does it take to kick this habit and to make that change stick? Dr. Panagis Galeatzedos is a pulmonary and critical care medicine physician. He oversees the Johns Hopkins Tobacco Treatment and Cancer Screening Clinic and co-directs Medicine for the Greater Good, a nonprofit that tries to close the gap between communities and the healthcare system. When we spoke in January, I asked Dr. G why it's so hard to quit smoking.
I love that question. And oftentimes when I give lectures to our medical students, to residents, and any physician, it oftentimes is the title of my talk. First, it just has a lot to do with where nicotine hijacks the brain. And you know, the neurological term is the mesolimbic area. In other more layman's terms, it's the reward center, right? It's the part of the body that if you do an action and the body liked it, it's going to make you feel good. It's going to make you feel great. It rewards you a little bit. And nicotine, and let me step back a little bit too here. It's not just nicotine, because we all eat. We all actually consume nicotine. Every listener here, I imagine, has eaten a fruit or vegetable, and a good portion of them have nicotine in them, but they're not addicted to those fruits and vegetables. You got to chemically enhance it and really bolus it in. Once it goes to that area and hijacks it, and they felt that reward, the brain ends up becoming more cognizant of the patterns that led up to it. Right, for some of your listeners, if they know of Pavlov's dog, that dog used to salivate every time Dr. Pavlov rang a bell. Well, it salivated because it knew it was going to get food. So for people who smoke, once they have that cigarette, their brain takes into account everything that led up to it, both external and intrinsic. And the more you do it, the more you do it, the more you do it, it becomes ingrained. And especially if you start at a young age, that ingrainment never goes away. If you talk to a person who stopped smoking, even if it's been more than a decade, they'll still tell you, I still get cravings around the bathroom where I used to go and hide and smoke my cigarettes. Yeah, that's a pattern recognition. So why is it so hard? Where nicotine hijacks is the reward center of the brain. It creates these patterns where every time you're in those certain environments and with those certain emotions, it's going to tell you to want to smoke. And the last thing I'll say is this. Of all the addictions in the world, most of them, most individuals can say, I'm going to cut A, B, and C out and never go back to it, right? If you drink alcohol, not going to the bar is one of the first things you do. You cut that out. You don't need to go to the bar. You're doing okay. But for people who smoke, when you really dive into them with those pattern recognitions, I smoke with my coffee. I smoke in the living room. I smoke in the car. I smoke when I'm stressed. I smoke when I'm happy. Those aren't things I'm going to be able to cut out. So what you end up dealing with the patient, end up helping them, is how to still be in those environments and with those emotions and help them choose to not to smoke. That's what's so key here. And that's what makes this addiction so hard.
Well, given all that, how often do people try before they're successful on average?
They try pretty frequently, right? They try pretty frequently. I would say most individuals, by the time they come to see me, I would say the average age is usually around 50 or 60. They've tried two or three times. I do also want to make it clear that physicians, I know I'm throwing my colleagues under the bus, and I do that with so much love so we can be better for our patients. We've really failed our patients to become non-smokers, right? So I sit down with students, right? And I will say, what's the medical definition for quitting? And every single one of them kind of stumbles. They're like, did I not learn this? The answer is no, there is no medical definition for how long being abstinent from a cigarette means you've quit. And I take that back to the patient because quitting is just a verb. If you are a smoker, you want to become a non-smoker. And that's the goal. So while you may have tried two or three times to quit, I usually ask them, what did that mean to you? Was it going a day without a cigarette? Was it going 3 months without a cigarette? What did that mean to you? Because the goal is not to get them to quit. That's part of it. The goal is to become a non-smoker.
How do people get connected to the Tobacco Treatment Clinic?
It's like any other clinic. They may just say, hey, I found it online. I'm going to send them an email and connect. Other times it's like their physicians may consult with us and send patients our way. But I would say to anyone out there, our email address is tobacco at jhmi.edu. You can always email us and set up an appointment. We get patients in pretty quickly, usually within 10 business days. And I can tell you of all the things I've done in my career, from being a critical care doctor to a lung doctor, helping patients become a non-smoker is the most rewarding thing I've ever done.
Tobacco at jhmi.edu. We will post that on the website. Tell us about the approach you take at the clinic. What happens when a new patient comes in?
I would say the first thing we do is actually try to rewrite the script with them. Most new patients, I will tell you, come in with their arms crossed. You know, they don't know what they're getting themselves into. You're like, are you just going to yell at me for 15 minutes? You know, and I make it clear, this is not my job is to try to undo all the stigma and judgment they have felt for so many other individuals from their own physicians sometimes. Why can't you just quit? So the first few minutes are just rewriting the story and the narrative. I tell them, and I catch them a little off guard with this, my goal is not get you to quit. So they look at me like, what am I doing here? Then I followed up with, my goal is to make you a non-smoker. That's your identity that you want. The second they recognize that, they're like, yeah, that is what I want. I don't want to quit and then relapse and quit, because most patients will tell you, I've quit thousands of times. So the goal is, first of all, to really catch them off guard with rewriting the narrative. After that, we spend probably then about 20 minutes going over why they smoke. And sometimes it's like pulling teeth, but I need them to be honest with themselves. I need them to say it out loud. I smoke with my coffee. It makes me enjoy the coffee more. Or I smoke when I'm stressed. It helps me calm my stress down. Or I smoke when I'm happy. I need them to tell me how many cigarettes they do in a day and when do they do them. They need to say this out loud, because becoming a non-smoker means you're going to be aware of those same moments and begin to come up with a game plan to say no to the cigarettes around it. They may ask me, like, Dr. G, how do I say no? I was like, I don't know. How did you say yes? You got to kind of have that come out organically, where it becomes a true new habit for you. And ultimately, now you're a non-smoker. Because a non-smoker means you're actively saying no to the cigarette whenever those cravings kick in. And they will also tell me where they think it's going to be an easy cigarette to say no to and a hard cigarette to say no to. And in good times and in bad times. Then after that, then we may discuss pharmacotherapy, medications. And I tell them the medication does not slap the cigarette out of your hand. You still have to be the one that says no to it. Because I'll have patients who are like, I want to do this on my own. I don't want a medication. I was like, okay, do you take Tylenol if you have some pain? Yeah. Well, Tylenol doesn't stop the pain. It just makes you not feel it so you can move on with your life. It's the same component here. These medications just reduce the cravings, make it easier for you still to say no to the cigarette. So we take that all into account. And then I come up with a plan for the next 6 weeks saying, in some capacity, to try to reduce your smoking consumption by a third. And if they get to it, great, tell me how they did it. If they didn't, tell me how they did into it. So the first visit is all about knowing, in the medical lingo, it's known as their smoking phenotype. But the first visit is really for them to say out loud, for the first time they're probably hearing it, without any stigma or judgment, why they smoke.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Hopkins pulmonologist Dr. Panagis Galiatseros of the Johns Hopkins Tobacco Treatment and Cancer Screening Clinic about how he counsels patients who are trying to stop smoking. What you're describing really is both mindfulness and medication.
You're 100% correct. The mindfulness is so important, because when patients smoke, at some point it becomes kind of an autopilot with them. Right? Because it's the only addiction you kind of have woven into your daily life, right? That's what's so frustrating about this, right? There's no other addiction where they're like, go take a beer break, go take a cocaine break. No, but there were smoke breaks at work. We've realized smoking as an addiction still doesn't rob you of your ability to be a functional human being. So people have woven cigarette smoking into their daily lives. And when they realize those patterns that have come about, I can't tell them to stop that. Oh my gosh, I would never tell a patient, stop drinking your coffee. So it is mindfulness, 100%. They need to be aware of their successes and their failures to saying no to a cigarette without any stigma, without any judgment, without any guilt. Because each time they're more aware of it, it sets them up for ultimate success at some point in time.
With nicotine replacement therapy, gums, lozenges, patches, how do you make sure someone doesn't transfer their dependence to those?
So is there a potential for those nicotine replacement therapies to have some level of addiction? There is. It's not chemically enhanced like a combustible cigarette is. Because remember, in combustible cigarettes, the traditional cigarettes, you need heat and you need all that tar in order to stabilize a kind of a enhanced nicotine molecule. I always give patients the same analogy, going from a grape to wine, you need some chemistry to convert it. So the nicotine replacement therapies in and themselves have a low, very low potential of addiction, right? You know, no one's ever put on a patch and leans back in a chair and goes, yes, I feel like I'm having a cigarette. Every patient, I give them that visual and they agree. The goal is to use these strategically when they, or their cravings are at their worst, so they can try to mitigate those cravings and then ultimately say no to it. So while we follow these patients, sometimes we'll use a long-acting agent like a patch, and then short-acting ones like the gum or lozenges. And what I try to take an inventory of is how they're using the, especially the short-acting products. Because the goal is ultimately to get them off cigarettes, and then yes, we take them off the nicotine replacement therapies. So Sheila, that's a great question. Ultimately, what it comes down to is trying to understand when they're using these products and then beginning to understand why they took two pieces of gum when they had this stressful moment, right? And come up with better strategies to respond to stress that doesn't revolve around wanting a cigarette or wanting to shut off the craving for a cigarette. So it is just close monitoring, close observation. I will say after their last cigarette, we do send them out with kind of a lifesaver, a metaphorical one, of some short-acting nicotine replacement therapies in case something happens. And I get, you know, they will report back to me telling me how they're doing and so forth. But close monitoring allows us to make sure we can pull that off and keep them just non-smoker without any other assistance other than some counseling and touch points as we move forward.
Briefly, as we wrap up, what's your message to people trying to stop smoking?
First, find a physician that you can confide in and say, this is what I want to do. Help me come up with an algorithm. Two, tell your family that that's the journey you're going to go into, and find supportive family members, ones who can empathize to some extent, knowing that you're going to go through something very challenging. And three, recognize that becoming a non-smoker doesn't happen overnight. It is a permanent journey, because even with your last cigarette, you'll still get cravings. So knowing how to be a non-smoker is a lifelong commitment, but it's a powerful one and it's a healthy one.
Dr. G, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Panagis Galeatzedos is a pulmonary and critical care medicine physician. He oversees the Johns Hopkins Tobacco Treatment and Cancer Screening Clinic. We spoke in January. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have links to more information about the clinic, as well as information about local smoking cessation programs across the state. Short break on the record. When we're back, career exploration for Baltimore City teens. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Do you remember your first job, learning the route to get there, depositing your first paycheck, getting to know your coworkers? For teens and young adults in Baltimore City, that opportunity may come this summer. YouthWorks is a job program housed in the Baltimore Mayor's Office of Employment Development. Young people ages 14 to 21 are matched to a local job site, earn a paycheck, and attend personal development workshops. The program will run for 5 weeks from July to August. Applications are due by April 7th. A few years ago, Kayla Malone spent her summer in the marketing department at a local bank.
Once you graduate, you get to jobs and they're like, we need you to be a recent college grad, but you need like 5 years of experience. I'm just like, how? I'm still trying to figure out what I'm passionate about, but thankfully I'm able to dip my feet in different places here at the bank so that I can kind of find that passion.
In January, I spoke with Senior Program Manager Rashim. YouthWorks partners with private, nonprofit, and city and state government employers in Baltimore. I asked Rashim for examples of where students have spent their summers.
Oh my gosh, so many different places. So I know Hopkins is a really big partner of ours, but there's also instances where small business such as salons or barbershops or Jubilee Arts or your local nonprofit organization that may be right up the street. There's so many different opportunities. There's also a pretty strong emphasis on CTE pathways. And so that's like career and vocational technology opportunities.
How many young people will be accepted this year?
Ooh, we hope thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands more than previous years, of course. On average, about 8,000 youth are able to participate each year. Last year, we were able to offer jobs to 6,000, to a little over 6,600. And then I would say even in years before that, like if I just went back from 2013 to present day, we've been able to offer over 75,000 jobs.
Wow. How many employers have signed on to host a worker?
So I could go by more specifically like last year's numbers, almost 500, about 450, 460. Right now, we are still accepting applications for folks to be work sites, whether they are in the private sector or in the public sector.
How long will you be accepting applications from employers?
We are accepting applications from employers all the way until April 14th. So sometimes in those instances, employers have interacted with youth in the community and they know exactly who they want to work with. In those instances, sites can select specific youth that they like to work with. In situations where they don't, but they have specific criteria, then we'll match a youth with their work site.
Tell me about how this matching process works. Can young people request a specific employer?
Yeah, to some degree, right? It's a little bit of the dating game. So how it works is when youth complete their application or when they're filling out their application, if they just have a general idea, they can elect what category or what field specifically that they're interested in. And there are some instances where we have larger contracted sites where they can identify, I would like to be a part of this program or I would like to be a part of this initiative, right? And if they are even more specific, they know, okay, I want to work specifically with Code in Schools. They can reach out to or have a conversation with Code in Schools, and then they're both match in a particular way. One way they're match is that youth can let us know that that's where they would like to be employed. But the best way to actually let us know is to let Code in Schools know. And what happens is Code in Schools will then type in that youth's name with also that youth's date of birth.
And for young people who don't have that specific an idea of what they want to do, how does the matching process work?
Yeah. So when the youth identify and say, oh, I want to do something specifically in the arts, and the work sites or the job or the employers, when they fill out their application, they say, oh, we do a lot of things connected to the arts. We look at that first, like what is their general interest? The second thing that we look at is where's their location? We don't want you to have to catch four buses to get to their job. So we look at what's also in that zip code. And then we also look at the work sites requirements. There's some work site or job opportunities that only want youth that are 16 or over, or for specifically what they do, they really want to work with 14 and 15 year olds. So those sorts of things go into the matching, like what is their shared interest? Are they able to accommodate this youth? What are the age requirements? How close is this to where the youth live?
A first job can be an overwhelming experience. How do you check in with youth to make sure they're adjusting to their placement?
A few ways. One of the ways is that we do, generally we do site visits. We also have surveys. We have a pre and post survey where we just really ask the youth about what their experience is like. Also, our social media is pretty active. For example, we have on our YouTube page, if a person were to go to YouTube and type in YouthWorks Baltimore, you would see different opportunities where youth voice and provide input into what some of their experiences have been. They can also, on every Monday during the program, during that 5-week program, we have something called Young Money Mentors. And what it is it's financial literacy. It's live at 1 p.m. on our YouTube channel. And not only do youth learn about financial literacy, they can actually engage with the speakers, and the speakers are other youth who have been trained in that particular arena. And then on Fridays, we have something called Bright Future Fridays, where youth interview people who are working in a particular field or have a educational background in a particular field, and youth can engage and ask questions. Right here in the office, what we have is we have a group of 10 young folks called our Youth Advisory Council. Our Youth Advisory Council kind of keep us cool, keep us in the know, if you will. And they kind of check the temperature and kind of gauge youth interest. They interview youth at sites on Wednesdays. There's something called Worksite Wednesdays, where they go to different work sites and they talk to youth about what they're up to and what they're experiencing. This year, we're in our first time of launching, I guess you could say, like a survey, if you will, to gauge what's the best place for youth to work in Baltimore. We're partnering with another organization to do that, Heart Smiles. And Heart Smiles is going to help us to craft something that is youth design and youth led to kind of engage youth and find out what is the best place for youth to work in Baltimore. And we hope to kind of feature and highlight what are those best locations.
You mentioned financial literacy discussions. Mm-hmm. What is the financial picture for these jobs? How much will the young people earn?
Yeah. So last year it was $12.75, and with the minimum wage increase, it is now $13.25 an hour. So if they work on the host end, where if they work with a nonprofit organization or a emerging business, and that's five employers or less, they will be paid that $13.25 an hour.
And how many hours a week?
5 hours a day, 25 hours a week. And if they are on the private sector side, they have an opportunity to potentially make more than that.
This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Rashim, the Senior Program Manager of YouthWorks, Baltimore City's job program for young people between ages 14 and 21. The application process is underway right now. Students will spend 5 weeks at their host sites this summer. In 2018, interns at Baltimore's Department of Housing and Community Development reviewed images of city blocks with vacant buildings. The data they collected was used to develop an artificial intelligence tool to detect collapsed rooftops. What other exciting projects have young people been able to work on?
I've seen situations where youth have been able to build technology, build laptops for other folks who may not be able to afford laptops. So they're able to build like lower functioning, I guess you could say, laptops. I know that one of the things that they've also been able to do is neighborhood revitalization is something that folks are continually able to do. And just starting to do more and help adults really look at things like social media platforms in a really different way.
There's also something called Core Council. What is that?
So it's a leadership development opportunity for youth who are interested in government or public service. Our goal really is to work with local city council to support the development of our future leaders of Baltimore by asking each of them to hire a youth worker.
How would you describe the kind of power YouthWorks has?
How much time you have?
A minute.
Right, a minute. So in a minute, the thing that I could tell you, I think one of the things that easily come to mind, right? This is additional revenue for Baltimore City residents in those households, right? It's also an opportunity for you to gain and develop new skills. They are also paired with caring adults in a lot of cases. They get opportunity to earn while they learn. Another great opportunity that recently started also is that youth, if they have to take summer school or make up summer school credits, they don't have to choose between employment and going to summer school. They can go to summer school and we will allow them to earn while they learn, so to speak. I also believe, and many studies have shown, that there is a positive linkage between summer job, youth employment, and crime reduction and violence reduction. And I think that summer jobs is not just an employment program, it is a crime reduction program.
It sounds exciting. I'm grateful to you for telling us about it, Rashim.
Sure.
Rasheem is the Senior Program Manager of YouthWorks. We spoke in January. At the On the Record page, we have links to the application and information for potential employers. Youth can apply to the program through April 7th. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're with us On the Record. Come back tomorrow.